As we get started with the message, and we're celebrating Memorial Day as a weekend here. How many of you have ever played the game, the board game Risk? Anybody? So if you haven't played it, it's a game where you're trying to conquer the world. Everybody gets to start with so many little countries and armies. And you battle. And you battle by rolling dice. And the attacker gets, your choice of one, two, or three dice, depending on how many you're attacking with. And the defender gets to roll their two dice. But when you're doing this, there are times that you could get very confident. I would play this with my friends, although I will say that I'm not sure that very many games ever concluded before someone threw the board in the air in anger. That happened a lot. But there would be these times when you would have 100 armies over here and you just were so confident that you were going to defeat the 10 armies over here. And the dice just didn't work out for you. You would roll one after one after one, and it's the high number that wins. And so they're rolling sixes, you're rolling ones, and the defender gets the win, the tie. So if it's a tie, they win. And I've been playing this game with friends. It's one that we would do as I was growing up, and you never knew what was going to happen. And the funny thing is, where that feels like it's just a board game, it actually rings true with reality. We would think that overwhelming numbers, that insurmountable odds would be what would define how a victory is won on the battlefield. But over and over again, sometimes that's true, but over and over again, in moments that turned history, God has shown us otherwise. One great example is in 1942, the Battle of Midway was an amazing U.S. victory against an overwhelming force. If you don't know the story and the odds of the Battle of Midway, this is after Pearl Harbor and many of the assets of the U.S. Navy had been destroyed. The U.S. was completely outmatched. The forces for the United States, there were approximately 26,000 soldiers, sailors, U.S. personnel in this battle. In the Japanese side, the Japanese had 106,000. So 26,000 versus 106,000. The United States had 360 planes. And the Japanese had 520. The United States had three carriers, and the Japanese had four major carriers, two battleships, 15 cruisers, and more destroyers and submarines. But as they fought and they continued and they persevered, the Japanese lost all four. All four of their carriers were sunk. 248 aircraft were downed, over 3,000 men killed. The U.S. lost one carrier, 150 planes, and 300 men. And this was the turning point in the Pacific. If this battle hadn't happened, Japan may have won. This is what turned it all around. And again, it was overwhelming. It was 4-1. And the number of soldiers that were there to fight. Yet, it isn't always the size of the force that matters. See, in Gideon's story, and we're continuing that this Sunday, we see that for God, His victory plan doesn't always look like ours. Because if we were writing the story, if we were going into battle, we would always choose to have more soldiers on our side, wouldn't we? I mean, if you're the strategist, you would say, why don't we have more than they have? Not more losses. But when God does things, He does them a little different. And He does this for a lot of reasons. And we're going to see that this morning as we go deep into Gideon's story. As a little refresher, we already learned that last week, the angel of the Lord finds Gideon where? Does anybody remember? In the wine press. He's threshing grain, in the wine press. And why is he there? Because he was hiding from the Midianites. The Midianites were coming in, and as soon as it was time for harvest, they were burning the fields, they were killing the field workers, they were starving the people of Israel. So we know that Gideon was afraid, but he was also pretty smart. Because he found a way to do this and to hide. And God approaches Gideon, and Gideon in his fear and his kind of being timid says, I'm not a warrior, but God says, you are a warrior. I need to move forward in the strength that you have. And that brings us into this part of our story. I accidentally left the midway picture instead of our other graphic, but it's Memorial Day, so it'll work. We'll start in Judges 6:39. Then Gideon said to God, do not be angry with me. Let me make just one more request. Allow me one more test with the fleece, but this time make the fleece dry and let the ground be covered with dew. So he has this fleece, and many of us wear jackets called fleece. It's like kind of a lamb's woolly feel. And he was putting this out there, and he was saying to God, God, if you want me to do this, and you really want to show me, then what I need you to do is make the ground dry and the fleece wet. And then later he says, make the fleece, the opposite of that, like he says here. One more test of the fleece. This time, keep the fleece dry, but make everything around it wet. That night God did so. Only the fleece was dry. All the ground was covered with dew. Early in the morning, Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, and all his men camped at the spring of Herod. The camp of Midian was north of them in the valley near the hill of Morah. The Lord said to Gideon, you have too many men. I cannot deliver Midian into their hands, or Israel would boast against me. My own strength has saved me. Now announce to the army, anyone who trembles with fear may turn back and leave Mount Gilead. So 22,000 men left. 22,000. Well, 10,000 remained. But the Lord said to Gideon, there are still too many men. Take them down to the water, and I will thin them out for you here. If I say this one shall go with you, he shall go. But if I say this one shall not go with you, he shall not go. So Gideon took the men down to the water. There the Lord told him, separate those who lap the water with their tongues as dogs lap from those who kneel down to drink. Three 300 of them drank from cupped hands, lapping like dogs. All the rest got down on their knees to drink. The Lord said to Gideon, with the 300 men that lapped, I will save you and give the Midianites into your hands. Let all the others go home. So Gideon sent the rest of the Israelites home, but kept the 300 who took over the provisions and trumpets of the others. It's an amazing story. Again, I don't know what I would have done if I was in Gideon's shoes. You start with 32,000 soldiers, and you're still kind of afraid. Is this 32,000 going to be enough? And God says, no, send 22 away. 22,000 soldiers. And then he cuts them down to 300. So clearly, God's victory plan, God's battle plan, doesn't look like ours. So what does it look like? Well, the first thing that we see is that when God calls us to win a victory, he starts by commanding us to tear down the altars. The altars to foreign gods, to idols. And while we may not build Asherah poles today, We have plenty of these in our culture, our society, and at times in our own lives. Gideon's first battle was against false gods. Earlier in 6, we read that Gideon is told to tear down your father's altar to Baal and cut down the Asherah pole beside it. As Gideon does this, he's afraid. He's like, the people aren't going to like this. And he's living in the land of the people of God, the land of the people who were delivered from Egypt, who had gone through the Exodus, who had seen the power and the hand of God upon them, but yet in his own father's household, in his own backyard, there is an altar to Baal, who is an evil god, false god that required child sacrifice, human sacrifice, evil, evil worship. This isn't like, oh, well, it kind of feels like what we believe. No, it's completely abhorrent. No connection to our God. And there's an Asherah pole. It's a phallic symbol that was there for fertility. And this is where a lot of sexual acts of quote-unquote worship would happen. It was gross. It wasn't pleasing to God. And God says, I want you to tear it down. I want you to burn it down. And on its ashes, there I want you to build an altar to me and make sacrifice. So Gideon, he goes and he does this under the cover of darkness. But the next morning, the people are mad. Read a couple of verses. In the morning, when the people of the town got up, there was Baal's altar demolished with the Asherah pole beside it cut down and the second bull sacrificed on the newly built altar. They asked each other, who did this? When they carefully investigated, they were told, Gideon's son of Joash did it. The people of the town demanded of Joash, bring out your son, he must die, because he has broken down Baal's altar and cut down the Asherah pole beside it. But Joash replied to the hostile crowd around him, are you going to plead Baal's case? Are you trying to save him? Whoever fights for him shall be put to death by morning. If Baal is really a god, he can defend himself when someone breaks down his altar. So something important is happening here. Because remember, Joash, Gideon's father, these were his altars. These were his idols. And he doesn't get mad at his son. Gideon's courage to say, I'm going to clean house. We're going to change the way we worship. We're going to refocus on our God. First was contagious to his own father. And sure, I'm sure that he didn't want to kill his son, that he had lots of motivations, but we see this starting to bring a rhythm, starting to bring some momentum as it goes from being Gideon choosing to follow God to now courage in his father, later courage in the soldiers. When the battle comes, it's natural to be afraid. In fact, if you're not afraid of difficult and hard things coming at you, that's not bravery, that's often stupidity. See, it's the overcoming of that fear that makes someone courageous and brave, not the absence of it. The absence of it is arrogance. And what happens to the arrogant? They normally get cut down. But for us, if we are going to win, if we are going to accomplish what God calls us to accomplish, it doesn't begin out there, it begins in here, with us refocusing our worship. So we can't expect to go out and win battles. We can't expect to go out and see our neighbors come to Christ, to see those who need to break the chains of addiction around us broken, to see marriages around us healed. We're not going to see the kingdom of God push up against the kingdom of darkness, not with us, unless we get our worship right. And that means we have to analyze. Maybe it's not an Asherah pole and an altar to Baal in our own life. Although these things are relevant, there was a concert just a couple of years ago that was a music festival devoted to Baal here in Fort Wayne. Which again, I don't think the organizers even fully understood what they were doing there, but that's what they named it. Maybe we don't worship those gods, but we do worship idols. We've all fallen into this. Maybe it's the worship and pursuit of material things, of status, of money, of relationships. Super easy for the object of our affection, that girl, that boy, that person, to be elevated above God in our lives. It's one of the big reasons that the people of Israel began to slip away is because the men of Israel would marry women of other nations and they would say, well, in our culture, when we worship this God, it would rain. And when it was dry, they would listen and they would say, well, let's bring that in. And slowly they began to slip away. But what is the first and foremost desire of your heart? And be honest, it needs to be God. But too often, we're distracted by other things. And if we're going to win the victory, if we're going to win the battle with the Lord, His plan begins with us cutting those other things down. And God doesn't come with condemnation, but He comes with conviction. So I can't tell you what it is, but I know that still small voice in your heart and your mind is probably speaking it to you even now. And if we're honest and we ask the question, God will tell. Okay, God, what is standing in the way of my worship? Because it will start there. God commands us to tear down the altars. The next thing we see, and I think this is fantastic news for each of us, is that God meets us in our fear. God meets Gideon in his fear, but he doesn't back down from his call. It's important. Do not be angry with me, Gideon says. Let me make just one more request. Allow me one more test. God had already done multiple tests and even sent the angel of the Lord down to speak with him. Gideon had more than most of us ever will when we're called to follow God. Yet he was struggling and he was afraid. And God doesn't condemn him for that. Instead, he meets him right where he is. Reminds me in some way of Thomas saying, I'm not going to believe. I can't move forward until I see the scars in Jesus' hands. Till I see where the spear touched his side. And Jesus comes up and he doesn't question. He isn't mean or harsh or brutal. He simply extends out his hands to Thomas and lets him touch the scar in his hands. God meets us where we are in our fear, in our doubt. He doesn't condemn us for that. But it doesn't change his call. You can be afraid and you can come to God afraid, but know that as God meets you, he will still accomplish his purpose and he still expects us to move forward. But God in his power will transform that fear into courage. We said before, courage isn't the absence of fear. It's when God overcomes it. It's when we know that there is a greater strength, a greater power in us than the thing that we are afraid of. Yes, there's risk. But our God overcomes that risk, and God is ready to meet with you in your fear. The worst thing you can do is close your eyes and say, I'm not afraid, I'm not afraid, I'm not afraid. We must acknowledge it, because that fear is acknowledging indicators and sensory inputs and things that often are real. I know we can be afraid of things that aren't there. We have to acknowledge the fear. When we're afraid of things out there that aren't there and we speak it out loud, it often goes away. But many times we're afraid of things that are real. And it's some of the smartest people that have a little bit of anxiety. I've seen this many, many times. It's not foolish people. It's people who have things dialed in, and they understand the risk. And when they do, there's an acknowledgement that we live in a world that's full of risk. It's full of hardship. It's full of reason to be afraid. I mean, it's amazing. Anything can happen when you walk out those doors. But the God of all creation is there to meet you right where you are. And if God calls you, He has the resources and the power and the wherewithal to get you to the other side. This is the God who separated the sea for the children of Israel. This is the God who delivered them from Egypt. This is the God who rose Jesus from the grave. The God who can heal the sick, who can raise the dead. He will meet with us right where we are. So if you are afraid, I'm not here to condemn you for that. Neither is God. But allow Him to meet you in that fear. Allow Him to sit with you in that moment. And allow Him to speak into your circumstances, into your fear, so that you can overcome it. Because at the end of the day, God doesn't back down from His call. I've talked to men of God, pastor friends of mine that waited a long time to become pastors, but when I've talked to them, many of them heard that call at a young age. And I've heard them tell amazing stories about how they have run from the call of God in their life. They have taken careers, they've done so many other things, saying, okay, God, I don't think so. And in the end, at least for the stories that I know, because they've become pastors, God finally, after 10 years, 20 years, 40 years, one of them it was 60 years, finally accomplished His purpose in them and never backed down from the call. But I'm hesitant to even use a story like that, because when you hear that, it associates the idea of call with somehow vocational ministry. And the reality is, of God's people as a whole, very few of us are called into vocational ministry, but all of us are called to do ministry. Peter, in his epistle, says that we are all a priesthood of believers. All of us are called to do the things that any of us who are vocational pastors do. We just do them while we're going, while we're out in the world. But just as God didn't let my pastor friends off the hook from their call, God won't let you off the hook either. And the good news is, it's not a day of judgment, it's not a day of sorrow when we walk into the calling that God has laid on our life. It's a day of joy and celebration. I'm not a good golfer, but I have swung a club. And this is rare in my life, but when you hit a golf ball just right, it doesn't hurt, it doesn't bounce off the divider and come back and hit you. It's happened before. But when your swing is just right, when you do it the way it was designed, you feel this little ping, and you can hear this little ping, and the ball takes off and it flies straight, something that I've rarely ever seen. And it goes way down the course or the driving range. See, when we do the thing that God has called us to do, this is the God who created you, who knows your future and your past better than you ever could. He's created you and He's lined up the circumstances and He's set the table before you. Now the moment you go and walk into this calling, the moment that you're used the way that you were built and designed to be, it's going to feel so right that everything lined up in a way that maybe you've never felt before. So the calling isn't meant to be terrifying, but it can be scary to get there. And God will meet you in that. But I encourage you, say yes sooner than later. Don't make God pursue you for 40 years before you finally say yes, God. And then God shows us less is more. God reduces Gideon's army from 32,000 to 300 to show His power. And the quote here from the scripture is, "But the Lord said to Gideon, 'There are still too many men.'" But let's look at what God does with those 300. Verse 17, "Watch me," he told them, "follow my lead. When I get to the edge of the camp, do exactly as I do. When I and all who are with me blow our trumpets, then from all around the camp, blow yours and shout for the Lord and for Gideon." Gideon and the 100 men with him reach the edge of the camp at the beginning of the middle watch. This is in the night. Just after they had changed the guard, they blew their trumpets and broke the jars that were in their hands. The three companies blew the trumpets and smashed the jars, grabbing the torches in their hands and holding in their right hands the trumpets they were to blow. They shouted, "A sword for the Lord and for Gideon." While each man held his position around the camp, all the Midianites ran, crying out as they fled. When the 300 trumpets sounded, the Lord caused the men throughout the camp to turn on each other with their swords. The army fled to Beth Shittash towards Zerah, as far as the border of Abel Maral, near Tabith. Israelites from Naphtali, Asher, and Manasseh were all called out, and they pursued the Midianites. Gideon sent messengers throughout the hill country of Ephraim, saying, "Come down against the Midianites and seize the waters of the Jordan ahead of them as far as Beth Barah." This is not a conventional battle. In the middle of the night, Gideon takes 100 of his 300 men, and they go and they blow their trumpets and they break these jars, and the men of Midianite are concerned, and then the other 200 blow their trumpets and they break their jars, and the Midianites are so terrified and overcome with fear in the night that they get up, they don't even know who they're fighting, and the scriptures here say they begin to slaughter themselves. They begin to fight their own soldiers. They begin to fight amongst themselves. And then in their fear and in their retreat, they are overcome by not just Gideon and his men, but other soldiers from around Israel. This faith, this renewed worship became contagious as it goes from Gideon to Gideon's father to Gideon's men, and then it spreads to the rest of the people and the soldiers of Israel. But God chooses to fight this battle in a way He makes it very clear. He said, if I go in and give the victory to 32,000 soldiers, then the people of Israel will say, look what we did. Instead, God says, I will win this battle with less, so that there is no question, and that the people here will look back over this for centuries, for many, many more years because we're still looking at this story. Thousands of years later, we'll say, look what God did. Look what he accomplished. But this lesson of God doing more with less is something that we must take a moment to resonate with. I know this because I have struggled at times in which God has shrunk my territory. Remember, we used to, was it the prayer of Jabez, the little book? And again, I'm not saying it was wrong, but it's hard for us to create like a whole new religion almost over one scripture. And there was this idea that it's a good thing, and we're like Americans, and we live in a capitalist world, and growth is good, and we want more and more and more. And so I think we're wired to think that when God gives us more, that's blessing. And when God takes away some of what we have, that's a curse. That's God's judgment. But the truth is here, God blessed Gideon by taking away. God took away his territory. He was a general of 32,000 soldiers. 1 hour, the next hour, he's a general of 10,000 soldiers. And then later that day, he's a general of 300 soldiers with trumpets. It's a glorified marching band. But this was not God's judgment on Gideon. This was God's blessing. And I know this because I've been through it, and I know this is something that many of you have gone through because some of you have been in my office with tears in your eyes as you've shared your story of why it's painful. Why is God doing this when he's pulling back and I'm having to do more with less? Maybe it's the job that you lose. Maybe it's the pay cut you take at work. Maybe it's losing a position on a board or in a volunteer group, or it's having to say goodbye to a friend. There are so many examples of where there's contraction. Where tomorrow we're going to learn how to get by with less than we had yesterday. And if we're not careful, we'll say, oh God, what are you doing to me? But in God's battle plan, for God in victory, sometimes less is more. And the elephant in the room for us is that many of us would love to be back in the sanctuary with it filled with people. And I'm not going to stand against that. But at the same time, if all we do is think about, okay, God, give us more people, give us more people, give us more people. If we're fixated on that, we miss the opportunity to do the discipleship and the growth that we have with those that are in this room. I've been a pastor of a church with a lot of people, and that has new problems, different problems, not no problems, not no challenges. And I want to see God touch lives, so numbers are good for that. Because numbers are people and people matter to God. But instead of saying, okay, God, fast forward, microwave us to that moment that we're bigger. I think we need to ask God, what do you want us to do when we are the size we are? When you've pulled back our numbers, what can you do in us to prepare us to win the battle ahead? And again, it's Memorial Day weekend, so we're using the language of battle, and that's okay. But I think we have to remember that God makes it clear that our battle is against our neighbor who doesn't mow his lawn, right? It's against the person who's in the checkout lane in front of us who has 45 items, but the sign says no more than five. No. Our battle is never against flesh and blood. But it's against principalities and powers in the spiritual realm. It's against the devil and his demons. And the good news is there's far less of them than there are angels in heaven. And the devil was never as powerful as God on the throne. So we're fighting a battle that he's already won. But it's okay if you're saying it hurts when I have less. True. But we need to acknowledge that God can do more with less. What did John the Baptist say in his Nazarite vow? He says, "May I decrease so that you, so that Jesus may increase. Less of me and more of him." So no matter where you are today, despite your fear, no matter your resources, God can and will make you a hero. That hero might not go out on the battlefield with a gun, and I want to recognize those who have sacrificed so much to do that. But for each of us, no matter your fear, despite your fear, no matter your resources, even if they contract upon you, God can and will use you to accomplish his purpose, and he will make a hero out of you the way he did Gideon. Oh, let's continue in worship.